This talk was given by Jody Hojin Kimmel Sensei at the Zen Center of New York City. Hojin Sensei is the head priest and training coordinator at Zen Mountain Monastery and co-director of the Zen Center of New York City. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you'd like to make a donation, please visit our website at zmm.mro.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
Good morning. Good morning. Nice intimate group today here at the temple. Thank you for coming. I wanted to talk about peace of mind. Stopping the war inside, so we can stop the wars in all worlds. And when I opened a tricycle, a new tricycle that came in, I liked this little tiny piece by Harada, Shoto Harada. He writes, "When we stop holding on to our thoughts, we observe each experience just as it is, freeing ourselves to address only what's necessary." So there are a lot of wars going on, and for most part, wars begin in the minds of people. It begins in our mind, in the seeds of our consciousness, and our misunderstanding of who we are. And we fight for it. Defenses and strategies to protect and conquer. And this is the way it's been for a long, long, long time. As the Buddha would say, it is better to conquer yourself than to win 1,000 battles. And we know that our circumstances are uncertain and uncontrollable, really. We don't have control. So it really turns us to observing our experience and working with our own heart and mind. Peace or war is our own decision. It's really up to us with our own mind. And the fundamental goal of practicing the Buddha way is peace. Not only peace in this world, but peace in all worlds. And I think most every human being, if not other creatures, just want peace of mind, harmony, happiness. And the great task of being vulnerable and loving is taking down the walls that separate us from our true self, which we're never apart from. The self is absolutely fine. That's why, like he said, just don't add on, just address what's necessary. From others. And we can attest to this as we sit down in our seat for a half an hour and observe, right? How many of us went into battle with someone or something or ourselves? And it's kind of shocking, especially those that are new. You come here, it's like, okay, I'm going to go meditate and like, get at, you know, just like peace, joy, bliss. And we come and we sit down for a half an hour and it's like chaos, battles, you know, anything but joy and bliss. Well, that's the point in a way, is to see what we do, what we carry. We see peace of mind is clearly an internal matter. And it begins with seeing into the nature of our own mind, of our mind, our thoughts, and then extend that outward. It's at the same time. It's seeing the inner world and it's external, and then kind of how that moves together. And so this is a zendo. We call this place a zendo. And sometimes we forget that it's not just the place around the corner, but it's a place where we do meditation or absorption or self-study. You know, Daido Roshi, my teacher, used to say, define Zen, and I never saw it anywhere else. He said, Zen is a way of using your mind, a very particular way of using your mind. That's what we're training in, a very particular way of using the mind, living our life, and doing it with other people. Harada writes, non-thought does not mean not to think. It means not to be carried away by any particular idea. We are human, so of course we think. That's what humans do. It has even been said that humans are legs that think. The purpose of Zen is not to become people who don't think, but to think only what we need to, not to be lost in unnecessary thoughts, but to see what is most necessary right now. So we come into this hall, which is, dhyana means absorption. Meditation is jhana, D-H-Y-A-N-A, which means absorption, and do is the hall or the room or the way. And maybe sometimes that zendo is your funky loft. I've went to someone's house and their zendo was in the bathroom, a beautiful bathroom, I must say, with stained glass, with a platform on a clawfoot tub with a zabaton and a zafu. And it was transformed into this space that you could feel it was imbued with a kind of attention and caring and sacredness, because that's really, they had to sit, the place they could sit, right on top of the bathtub. But when I walked in, it was a zendo. And I remember this fellow, his name was Huey Campbell. I lived in this on a creek in a cul-de-sac, and there was a shack there. And I never knew what went on in that shack, but I heard there was some artist that lived there, and his name was Huey Campbell. Well, one day, there was a bunch of trash outside outside the hut, and I was like, oh my God, there's activity at the hut. What's happening? And it was piles and piles of his drawings and paintings. It was raining, it was drizzling. And I was freaking, I was like, did he die? Like, this is his place. Maybe he died and somebody put his stuff out. So I went home and I got a wheelbarrow and I made several trips back and forth to save all this artwork. God knows I didn't have enough of my own that I had to save a huge pile of his, but it was amazing. And it was all about the town of Mount Holly where we lived. And then I was curious about this little shack there. It was just like a tin roof and one door. And I cleared a spot and I couldn't quite see in, and I touched the latch. And it clicked, and it was open. And so I went in, and the sun came out. At that very moment, the sun came out, and I was like, wow, and it went right through his hut as I walked in. And on the shelf where there were spices, all these colors were lit up, and he had his pigments in clear spice jars, his painting pigments, all lined up. All these colors. And there was a stove that was as wide as this lectern, just a single stove with a tea kettle on it. And then right behind that was a sitting platform with a big Tara, Bodhisattva. And I forgot at that moment the space I was in. It was gigantic. And I'll tell you, this thing was so tiny. So I could feel his absorption. I could feel his practice in that place. The moment I walked in, I was affected by this space. called the Zendo, this place we come together to practice. And this is a word we use a lot, practice. I met Huey Campbell, but that's another story. I'll tell you if there's time at the end. Sorry, cliffhanger for next talk. He also wrote a book, Knock Vigorously to be Heard. I found out, poetry. Practice, my practice, your practice. And Dogen, Master Dogen, who's a 12th century Zen master, who a lot of our training here in this order is his teachings, he said practice is awakening, practice is enlightenment. The moment we practice, the moment we turn towards practice, engaging our life in a particular way, that is the awakened nature right there. So he takes away the whole kind of instrumental idea that we practice in order to, and he says, no, 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 no. This is it. This is it. What you're doing, it is it. What we do here is it. And what you do at home is it. The awakening. And we gather together because it strengthens our practice. We need each other in this sitting down. We can do it alone, but it takes tremendous discipline and self-power, which is empowering. Many of you do it. It'd be great to keep the consistency going. In other words, create your space, create your Zendo, create your place of practice to turn towards. In other words, we do not attain a goal by means of practice. Practice itself is the goal of realization. Just like when we take up art practice, it's not whether we get a painting or a poem. It's the process itself. It's the engaging of that mind in this creative process. That's the awakened nature expressing itself. This posture, that's why we sit, we put so much emphasis on the posture, because that's, you're an awakened being. You enter into that temple, this temple. So last week I went into the archives at the monastery. We have a basement that I've been saving stuff since the monastery started in 1980. I wasn't there, but I became the archivist. And because I like to collect things. And and so I went down just last week and I found something, a sheet of music from, a couple sheets of music from Gengen Savage, Robert Gengen Savage, who used to be a student back in 1986. And he was there when I got there in 1990. This was tucked into some of the sheet music, something he wrote about his practice. He was an artist in residence. And Gengen died in 1993 of AIDS. And this was written in 1986. And he wrote, even if sitting achieves nothing spiritual, and he puts in parentheses, and now that's a weak and muddled word, the mere taking stock of oneself every morning, putting aside so-called immediate concerns and seeing exactly what's left, that by itself justifies wasting 40 minutes a day. Putting aside immediate concerns and seeing exactly what's left. I really like his description. Just right now, if you could think, putting aside the demands, the fantasies, the stuff, the duties, just putting all this aside as we sit down, what's left? All the kinds of machinations of mind, the conditioning, put it aside. That's what we do for a moment, maybe 20 minutes, 35 minutes, if not 40, to be present, to what's left. Isn't that wonderful? Another way to say it, as Dogen might, is drop away. To let all that drop away. Just let it drop away for that period of time. All the ways we think about ourselves, about others, this kind of crazy, illusory rules that we make up, that we feel like we have to follow. Just let it drop away. That's what we're doing. How we should be, how others should be. To just sit still with my simple self for a few minutes every day. What would that be like? What does that take? What happens when we do this activity of sitting as an awakened being? What's the point? How do we find peace of mind? What happens in that, at least for me, is we re-enter the depth of our life. We enter the reality of our breath, which is this moment. We can only breathe now. You can't breathe later. You can't breathe back then. So the breath as our object is always now. Now, it's so simple. Now, go to your breath. Walking down the street, getting crazy. In a phone call, somebody right in your face. Go to your breath. That's now. It connects you to body, gets you out of the head and the splitting, the separation on the spot. This is practice. As soon as we turn towards it, that's awakening in that very moment. And I'm always struck by how easy it is, and you must be too, to slip into that imaginary space, because that's what we've been doing for so long. The idea of myself, the idea of you, the idea of what I'm doing, having to explain myself, like sometimes sitting there just explaining myself to myself. Jesus, give it a break. And that's what we get, like with practice. It's like, give it a break. We're learning how to give ourselves the spaciousness we are, so we can actually experience very directly. And no one gives it to us. Sorry. It's up to us. It really is. And it's not possible, at least I, to measure up to my idealized version of me, right? Oh my God, that's my biggest war is like this idealized version of myself, right? Who we think we should be and how we never measure up. It's so exasperating, excruciating, all the comparisons and gosh, jealousy is like, ugh, it's such a killer of an emotion, but we have it, some more than others. It would be kind of horrible if we measured up to this perfect version of ourself. If you think about it, kind of a nightmare, this perfect self, the perfect self. And then we come back to what Genjin wrote, what's left? What is what's left in your life? You know, Daido would say, when the thinker disappears, the thoughts disappear. When the thoughts disappear, the thinker disappears. And there's someone in this room that has the answer. Don't look at me. But how did we lose it? I wonder. So this led me to a koan of Bodhidharma's peace of mind, which Bodhidharma, if you don't know him, you probably see him in museums. He's the guy without the eyelashes. That's kind of like a Harry Potter image that his eyes are bulging because it said he didn't want to sleep in Zazen, so he removed his eyelashes. I know Zen has some pretty vulgar bits, and it's going to get worse as I talk about this. But so his eyes are like bulging out. He's got no eyelashes, bushy eyebrows. He called him a barbarian. Long hair, wasn't like me, like we're take it off. It's long hair, earring. And it's sort of like anywhere you go in the room, if you're encountering his painting, his eyeballs follow you. And you feel like, what? What? You know, wherever you're at, he'll just like, you know, give you some feedback, and he brings up a mirror, sort of like, you know. So he is considered the founder of Zen in China. He's an Indian monk that came to China and brought the teachings there, and it's said that he sat for 9 years in a cave facing a wall. There's volumes from scholars on debates as whether he's a composite of several teachers or was actually one person. Doesn't matter. You can do your research. But for the sake of this piece, he's Bodhidharma. And the scene takes place where he's in the cave facing the wall, snowing like mad. Okay, it's like piling up outside. And he's in Zazen, and the second ancestor, who is sometimes called Huiko, Eika, Shinko, not the second ancestor yet, comes to request that, please, he's standing outside, and he says, please give me the teachings. I'm trying to find peace of mind. Please help liberate me. But Bodhidharma won't listen to him. And he won't even acknowledge him. He just sits there. And this guy's out there and the snow's like piling up. And he refused to teach him, saying, finally he spoke to him and he said, the subtle and supreme teachings of the Buddhas can be pursued only by endless assiduity. Doing what is hard to do and bearing what is hard to bear. Continuing the practice even for kalpas. How can a man of little virtue and much self-conceit dream of achieving it? It will only end in fruitless labor. Okay, this guy's like out there in the snow and this is what he says. You little conceited, you know, person, like nothing's going to happen for you. This takes like so long. But yet here's this person. Go away. I can't help you. So how many of us would actually stay with this kind of rejection? Some of us would, and some of us would just be like, I can't do this. I can't take it. But he stays. And to prove his aspiration, it said that he cuts off his arm to present it to the teacher. And you can imagine, and I'm very visual. Okay, so it's white snow and he cuts off a half an arm. I mean, look what's there now. You see it? It's just a bloody friggin' mess. There are some koans like this, but you got to get below the scene, okay? It's just showing a kind of resolve and cutting off, wanting so desperately to cut off delusions. We do it here. It's like we don't cut our arm off, but you came here this morning. That's kind of like cutting off your arm, you know? You came to sit down. Please, show me how to liberate myself. Go away. I can't help you. So he says, after a while, he says, bring to me your mind and I'll put it at rest. And I'll put it at rest. Bring it to me. Okay, bring me your mind that's not at peace and I'll put it to rest for you. And so the second aunt, Huika, goes away, and we don't know for how long. Is this a week? Is this a month? Is this after 5 sessions? Is this years? But he comes back and he says, I have searched and searched for my mind and it is finally unattainable. I can't find it. I can't find it. And Bodhidharma says, there, I have thoroughly put it at rest for you. You see? This leaving it go, this, what Genjin said, what is left? I can't find it. I can't find it. Now in the koan, my mind has no peace. Only when it's emptied can it actually find that, in a sense. And he's asking, please pacify my mind. Can anyone do that for you? Can anyone pacify your mind? We can't pacify our mind while we're asking others to do it for us. We're looking outside. So when I first heard this koan, I thought, yeah, right. There, I've set it at rest for you. Really? Really? But that's what Genjin wrote about. When we search and search for the mind facing the wall, it is this simple practice of Zazen. You don't complicate it at all. You just face the wall. That is what we practice. And that is the heart of it. He said, bring your mind here. You cannot find your mind, yet much less bring it forth. This is the footnote. I will pacify it for you. Footnote says, peace of mind is spontaneously brought about. I have searched for my mind. Human beings have searched. Have long searched for the mind. I cannot take hold of it. You can take hold of it, but not in the way you expected. We're creating a container that will allow us to sit and face the wall. And when you do it at home, that's what you're creating, a way, a structure for you to take it home and sit, even if it's for 40 minutes or 20 minutes, that time to be present to your life. That's what we practice. And so many dedicate lives to this. That's what Bodhidharma divided his life to. And, you know, we're a pretty lively sangha. We don't just sit. We do many things. We have different kinds of teachings, sometimes even parties, celebrations, performances. But it's all supporting ourselves so that we can take a moment to drop into real life, who we really are. And this is what Huiko was doing, standing in the snow. So a little back history on Huiko. He was very well read. He had been a scholar of all the teachings, so this is very well read, really smart, scholarly, but he hadn't reached the point where he could experience the teachings. Okay, so we can read a lot and be very moved in our mind intellectually, but it's the experience, it's the whole body and mind experience. It was as if there was a wall and he had read and studied everything, but what he wanted was to experience. That was somewhere else. So he was willing to stand in the snow, freezing cold, and beg this guy, this reputable old man facing the wall, beg him to give him some teaching, cutting off his arm to show his wholeheartedness. as I said, cutting off his delusions or cutting off that which reaches for something outside of ourself. This is one of the hardest things, I think, and it's coming in more clearly as I get older and practice longer. These kind of subtle places where, personally, I still want to be saved. Like, it is up to me. It's my mind. But I still want something to intervene and, like, zap me somewhere. And this is a hard thing to keep pulling back our projections and looking externally for something to happen. So we have an image upstairs of Manjushri. That's kind of our cutting off the delusion imagery in our tradition. So if you look upstairs, there's a image on a riding a lion with a big sword, and it could be male or female, but she's always ready to cut, to get rid of those inmost fantasies and ideas when they're not needed. What is most necessary right now? The ideas that we have that aren't true, that we know some of them are entertaining and some of them are useful for other aspects of our life, but they're not helpful in being present to just this moment. That's really it. It's that grasping that separates us, that takes us away from this direct experience. We're so filled. And it just takes a moment, because your temple, you have stillness, spaciousness, and silence all the time to turn to. I don't know if anyone was around, but we did a play at the monastery. We did a show on Bodhidharma, and we sang it to the song Tradition. It was our anniversary, so we put, I am Bodhidharma, I can come to Maya, da, da, da. And Yukon played Bodhidharma, and Kaishu Moody played Huika, and we made a little arm out of plaster, so it was up his sleeve and, you know, got cut off. And then Gokhan was the postman who delivered UPS, who delivered snow, and we dumped it on, and we kind of did the whole scene. And I guess this is just to say, we went on a camping trip shortly afterwards, and I was getting in my sleeping bag, and there was the arm. And Shugen Roshi put it there. I knew this because I could smell it on him. And he kept looking at me, like waiting for me to, like, say, and I wouldn't say, and he was looking at me like, well, like, I knew he was, did you see the arm, you know, like what, I'm going to scream, like a plastic arm in my, so. So, in other words, this arm cutting, this cutting off delusion requires a bit of sacrifice, we know this, a kind of a surrender of sorts within ourself. And that gets easier to do after a while. But beginning, we have to make choices about what we're doing with our life, about what we're cutting. Our mind is not at peace. We come in hoping, wanting peace, as if somebody could give us peace. So how do we find that in our life, that peace? How can we be free? And someone in this room has the answer. It's here, right now. If we could hear it, if we can turn towards it. And Daido used to say, a good teacher is a spiritual boomerang. That's pretty, I like that. So student throws it out, and the teacher can just let it keep going back in. They don't block it. that they know where it is. They know the one who has the answer is right here. And that's all that happens in that interaction, is just letting that boomerang come back home. And sometimes that cutting is harsh or seems strong, and sometimes it's rolling out and really kind, whatever the person may need. And it's alive. It's a relationship. It's a relatedness on the Dharma. And years ago, I read a lot of books on the Holocaust, but particularly this one by Viktor Frankl. Some of you have met it, Man's Search for Meaning. And I pulled up this line that always, he had many great things that he said, but this one always comes back to me in these moments where I feel like, I just feel like futile. You know, there's times in practice where it just, you know, if in my particular karmic constitution, you know, I'm just like, I don't know if I can do this, you know? What's the this? And what I is doesn't think I can do this. There's that perfect self appearing. What am I seeing as I should be at that moment is where I have to look. But he said, everything can be taken away from a person but one thing, the last of the human freedoms, to choose one's attitude in any given set of circumstance, to choose one's own way. Dido Bodhidharma would implore, don't bring me all your thoughts, your concerns, your formulations of what's true and what is not. Turn the light around. Shine the light inside, not on concepts, but on the mind itself. Go directly to your mind. Let the breath lead you. It may not look like what you think, like the things in here, the brain, the thoughts. It's not what we're talking about. This mind is gigantic. This body is gigantic. Let your breath lead you to see for yourself. You can't attain the mind. How are you going to wrap around it? Where does it begin? Where does it end? But we get caught in a very small portion between our two ears. Bodhidharma doesn't try to fix it. He puts the responsibility back where it belongs. Not go find the contents of your mind, but go find your mind. I can't. I looked. I searched exhaustively. I can't find it. There. You at peace? Is it peace? So we set up the best circumstances for ourselves. And it could take a while, years of practice, to see how ungraspable it is, right? Because we still like want to own a piece of the rock, a little real estate along the way. You know, Shugen, I remember in session, the last session, Sean gave this very effusive, loving talk, and Shugen did the next talk, and he said, I'm the bad guy. I'm going to take everything away. Like, everything you love the most, if you think about the thing you love the most, has to go. Has to go. It's so ungraspable. It's what the Diamond Sutra says. The mind is vast and open, clear. Things pop up, pop away, but it cannot be grasped. Because it's flowing. It's flowing through time right now. It's always right here, with you right here. And yet it's so easy to put up a wall and miss it. Miss ourself, our life, our very life. And what came to mind was Blake's poem, London. He had, and just the word in it, he had this line about mind-forged manacles. I don't know if you remember that, read that. I just, that one, I love those grouping of words, mind-forged manacles. And so that's all I remembered about the poem. And so I went and looked it up, and he said, I wander through each chartered street near where the chartered thumbs does flow, and mark in every face I meet marks of weakness, marks of woe. In every cry of every man, nobody else is there, of course, in every infant's cry of fear, in every voice, in every ban, the mind-forged manacles I hear. Mind-forged manacles. The mind forges these handcuffs and chains and shackles, and the breath of fresh air, that's zazen, to break the shackles. As Dogen says, that when one first starts seeking the Dharma, one is very far away from its environs. But when one has transmitted the Dharma to oneself, one is one's original self at that moment. So that may sound far-fetched, but it's really just returning to your breath, returning to your practice. That's transmission of the Dharma. Doing what you're doing while you're doing it wholeheartedly, like simply walking or what we practice in Kint, that is the transmission. That is awakened nature right there. And we just bring that in, practice that. So that's just how we are. And we see those mind-forged manacles, those shackles come, and we got the key. It's a bubble. Bubble in a stream. And we always think that we have to know. We have to know it, but we don't. Delusions still arise, but we do know there are delusions. We don't have to get hard and mean on ourselves. We can dance with them a little bit. Oh yeah, there's that. But we just don't take it as the truth anymore, this mind-forged manacle. It's not the truth. It's a wave of the mind. And we begin to have a vast field. And we exhibit patience with ourselves, endurance. So there's a Zen saying, the sky does not obstruct the white cloud's flight. The sky, which is vast and boundless, does not obscure the clouds, the white cloud's flight. Cezanne wrote, if you want to understand the nature of reality, paint clouds. It's great if you've never tried it. Just look up paint clouds and you'll understand yourself. The storm coming through, the black cloud coming through, the white cloud coming through. Giacometti would say all clouds are purple. Don't you know that? The purple clouds coming through. We can tolerate all of it with a sky like mind. No obstruction when we're able to have a wide, spacious view of our mind. There, I've put it at peace for you. Dogen says in the Genjo Kon, when Buddhas are truly Buddhas, one need be aware of being a Buddha. We just go along. Others may notice something, maybe not, but you just go along. It's not really our business. It's nothing special at all. see. Oh, too much. I'm either too much or not enough. That's the default. It's like, right? Oh, I'm too much. I'm not enough. So, in beginning instruction, those of you that did it, did you hear, put your mind in your hara? Did you learn about the hara? Great. That's a real important part of our nature, of our body, of our body-mind connection. It opens up a more intuitive aspect of our being. It's the center of gravity, of allowing the flow to not get caught in our head if we dropping down here to the, in Japan they would say, put your mind in your hara. And there's, I'm paraphrasing from a book called The Hara, just to give you a little taste of the person who has hara can wait. We can be patient in all situations and always have time. We can look on calmly. We feel no urge to interfere constantly. Okay, so you bring it down to your heart if you're like meddling around in yourself. Bring your breath, attention to your breath, to the hara. The more practiced we are in our hara and the more we come to know this power which gives tranquility and patience, the more quickly we recognize in every stirring of impatience that we have deviated from our own true center and have fallen under the sway of eye-making. The person who has hara is composed. Thus hara is valuable for every form of nervousness. Unnecessary movements cease and all restless jerking and twitching of the limbs. It is as if peace had entered the body, an inner calm which is not lifelessness, but the expression of a tranquil, self-collected harmony. Hara reestablishes being undivided, unified. There is one more thing to keep in mind. While these instructions can help us establish our own daily meditation, Zen is not a solitary practice. Using our mind, living our life, doing it with others, sitting with others, studying with others, working with others, talking with others, these are all integral parts of the life in Zen. Please put my mind at rest. Find it. Bring it here. Nothing can bring you peace but yourself. The first step is understanding the causality of peace. If the minds of living beings are at peace, the world will be at peace. Just as a mother would protect with her child with her life, her only child, even so let one cultivate a boundless love toward all beings, wishing in gladness and in safety, may all beings be at ease. Metta is for us. You know, sometimes if we're hurt by someone, we've hurt someone, maybe we can't bring ourselves to wish gladness for someone. It's not for someone. It's for you. It's for me. The practice of metta, of loving kindness, is for oneself and towards oneself and towards others, if possible. That's important. I just heard this in a different way recently. Metta is for ourself. It's for us to live with such a mind. So I'll end with a little bit from Harada's Shoto Harada. Non-abiding or non-attachment is the characteristic essence of mind. With non-attachment, we have no time to get caught on things. We are always flowing. When we stop flowing, our mind becomes foul like stagnant water, or fixed like frozen water into ice. If we are distracted by extraneous thinking while doing zazen, it is not dangerous. But if we are driving a car and get lost in our extraneous thoughts, it's dangerous. The non-abiding mind of zazen is not just for being in the zendo. Whether we are sitting, moving, working, silent, or speaking, all of it is zazen. The cultivation of flowing mind is zazen. Then we become the flower, become the moon, become the stars. Absorbed in them, we become everything we encounter completely and totally. That is our correct state of mind. Okay. Thank you. And let's keep sitting for this, for ourselves and for the peace of your mind and for this planet. Sit on our great mother as the Buddha did, touching the earth, raising his hand and saying, "This is my witness."
Thanks so much for listening. For meditation supplies such as meditation cushions, incense, malas, liturgical instruments, books, and more, visit the monastery store at monasterystore.org. Support for your spiritual practice at home.